And good evening or good morning, everyone, and welcome to the other side of midnight. That magical time when, you know, this used to be a special time. Now, if you're looking at the news, it's madcap, strange, bizarre, weird, other side of midnight stuff 24/7. And tomorrow night, we're going to really get into the thick of it because we're going to be talking with Steve Bassett for the first hour. He's got some very interesting ET UFO updates, and of course, he's in the center of the storm. You know how they always say that hurricanes are very calm in the middle of the eye? Well, I've actually lived through a few hurricanes and had the eye go across, and that's true. But if you're in the eye wall, which Washington, D.C. right now appears to be, it's anything but calm. And, you know, Steve, as you know, Stephen has a opinions on almost everything, and he has some very intriguing opinions about the president and disclosure and what's going on the Hill. There are things going on. Remember, our prediction is that disclosure in some form or another, where people who haven't been following, you know, the increasing openness of agencies and researchers and NASA, you know, saying we're going to announce life on Mars in 2 years. If people aren't noticing all that stuff, they should be noticing that we are moving closer to something. Who was that guy at MIT who talked about a singularity? Anyway, we may get into that tonight, because tonight's going to be a very interesting show. You know the old joke, two guys walk into a bar. Anyway, tonight we're in 10 Forward, which is the lounge of the USS Enterprise. And we have as our guest Ron Gerbron, who has a remarkably intriguing and broadly diversified background. If you go to theothersideofmidnight.com, that's our homepage, click on tonight's banner, which is Two Generalists Walk Into 10 Forward for October 26, 2019. Click on that. Let me give you a background, a thumbnail sketch on who we have on tonight. Ron Gerbron, of course, among other things, is a member of the Enterprise Mission Imaging Team. He has been writing remarkable information to be included in our prospective Mars book. And yes, we're still working on the Mars book. I don't want people to get discouraged. You know, I'm a great fan, as you know, the old Gallo wine commercial, make no wine before it's time. And we're waiting on a few more items, but I guarantee you that when we bring the book out, it's going to be well worth the wait, because, well, some of the things that are going to be in the book, we're going to talk about tangentially tonight, some of the implications, and the data, of course, will be in the book. So you're going to want to obviously get a copy as soon as we have it available. It is it's coming. Let me just say that it is coming. Ron is a proudly uncredentialed polymath. He wrote that. With a proudly uncredentialed and deeply interested background in archaeology, he was raised on a farm in Pennsylvania, and he collected arrowheads as a child. I never got around to doing that. I was more into wildlife, you know, keeping snakes in the kitchen and insects and rescuing lots of birds, including robins. Anyway, he found the programmatic aspects of education about everything back then a bit limiting after attending a very famous Quaker school in Pennsylvania. And ahead of his studies and his time, he attempted to contort himself into attending college for a while before giving up on academia and moving overseas, where, of course, he got an extraordinary education, as we're going to talk about. In all that time, Ron has focused his core attention on the metrology of our paleohistory, particularly on other planets, especially the planet Mars. So without further ado, Ron Gerbron, welcome to the other side of midnight.
Well, hello, Richard. Hi, everybody else.
Hi.
What a wonderful intro. Most of it was even true.
What was this famous Quaker school in Pennsylvania? I've always been intrigued with the Quakers.
Oh, yes. The interesting thing about them is that you learn about everyone's religions. I mean, they're really closer to theosophy, although they hate it when people say that. as a, you know, if you want to know a kindred spiritual movement, they more grew out of that. That's why it's called officially the Society of Friends. Quaker was something that people should pay attention to in these excessively woke times, because that was an insult word that was coined by one of opponents.
We kind of lost you for a moment there.
Anybody that rocked the boat was a problem, and it was basically a youth movement when it started, believe it or not. Young people running around, a very famous girl named Hannah became the first martyr. Not that they have a lot, I mean, they're all about pacifism, because she ran through a town to advertise their presence, but she was naked at the time. And in the 17th century, that was, let's just say that bad things happened to her.
Well, here's a question I've always wanted to ask, and I never knew who to ask, so I'm going to ask you. If the official name of the church is the Society of Friends, is that correct?
Yes.
Where did the term Quakers come from?
That's what I'm coming to. The John Fox, founder fellow, was writing about the ecstasy of it looks like something out of Eckankar or something, you know, writing about the ecstatic experience of appreciating, approaching, merging with God, this kind of thing. And he said he was quaking with the glory of the Lord. And so this mocking editorial was written about what he said. And the guy made a big deal out of the fact that he had said something as preposterous as quaking in the presence of the Lord. And so he dubbed the whole movement Quakers. And
wow.
I wasn't there at the time, but, you know, people thought about it. Not quite. A couple weeks later. The people talked about it and said, well, okay, we'll call ourselves Quakers. You know, they embraced, it's a pacifism thing, I guess. They embraced the insult instead of getting all offended. And like I said, the people might take that to heart, but that's where that came from. You know, it's like the Mormons are technically, what is it, Church of Latter-day Saints,
right.
Of Jesus Christ or something. And Mormon isn't a proper term either. They don't like it much, but they're a little crankier.
Well, as long as you're on Quakers a roll, where did Mormon come from, and what insult was that supposed to mean?
Ooh, I believe that was a name, but you got me there. I am not an authority on the what led up to that glorious tabernacle they have down in La Jolla.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, they have lots of money, and they do very good archaeology because they're intent upon building their case for New World era civilizations that predated anything else. And if you've ever read through the Book of Mormon, you know that's what they're talking about, a past civilization here. It's not as – doesn't strike me – well, I don't want to say anything bad about them, but let's just say it's kind of a less rich and metaphorical read than like the King James Bible. But, you know, it's a nice story, you know, but they say stuff like the and then great battles ensued, which take up too much space to mention here, and then just move on to something else. Honest to God, that's not even much of a paraphrase of something that caught my eye in there. It's a good read. People should read these things. I don't know much about them. And strangely enough, they're a group that the Quakers don't get along with much. So
that's interesting.
You know, normally you think they'd get along with everybody.
Yeah.
And they're, of course, they're quite a bit more left-leaning politically in current days than I ever was, but I think a lot of the membership is like that too. You know, it's like, I don't know, never, I needn't talk about them. The school's name, however, is Westtown.
Okay. Let me skip forward. You know, as part of your bio, you basically gave up on academia, which of course is not a bad thing. But then it says it says you moved overseas. I mean, if you're a kid, you know, jumping on a tramp steamer and going to Hong Kong, where did you go overseas and what was that like?
Okay. No. That all started with the first time I left the country was in college. And it was a college trip, but, you know, not just a hapless week long trip to Venice like Spider-Man just had or something. It was something it's still around, but they changed the name. I think they call it Semester at Sea now.
Mm.
It was once called World Campus Afloat. And I think it even had another name for a year or two before that started. But it was a 506-foot ship that had been built back at the end of World War II as a troop carrier, but that it turned out they didn't need it. So they refitted it into a passenger liner. And, I love old ships like that.
Was this one of those famous Liberty ships?
Yes. Yes, it would be one of those. And that was it's called the Rhine Dam. And they reused that name one time since then. It's not the same one that is floating around now, taking people up to see icebergs. But it's, Holland America Line. And have nothing but good things to say about them and their ships and the whole thing. And I like the older ships better than the new ones. I've been on, not for a cruise, but I've been on like one of those new Carnival liners.
Mm.
I wouldn't even enjoy that. It's like a casino. It's too posh. You know, same reason that driving, I would usually not even turn the radio on unless it was somebody else in the car or I was listening to a news story. You know, you just kind of listen to your environment.
So you're in college and part of the curriculum involves getting on this ship and going somewhere. Where and for
how
long?
Yeah, we were taking classes. All around the world.
God, what an adventure.
I know, and it was better back then than now, only because of the volatility of so many environments. But that got me started, and I realized that I really liked that. So I did that four times, which is more than most people. It gets very, very cheap if they like having you around and you're good with shepherding the cats. And so they said, no, this is somebody we want in the mix here. So that was fine, but that was about all they had for that. And then I went on to other things.
So where did you go? I mean, you know, you were what? You were early, late teens, early
20s? Well, let's see. Yeah, no, I was 18, 19 at the time. And West Africa, Senegal, Sierra Leone, Morocco, South Africa, over around the other side to Kenya and down into Tanzania, and never been to Egypt.
God.
It wasn't like a Mediterranean cruise. Portugal. Portugal's cool. More people should go to Portugal. The Portuguese are really, really interesting. And Spain, of course, because it's like right next to it. And went up to Andorra. And that wasn't part of anything official, but that's the only place you can see Paleolithic plants and animals. Not so many critters, but I mean, the trees and everything. See, they never suffered any ice age. They were shielded there in the Pyrenees.
Right.
And so that's what the flora and fauna looked like 12,000 years ago in the rest of Europe, which is kind of interesting. And England and Ireland. No place in the world is greener than Ireland. That's true. I don't know why.
Despite Winston Churchill calling England this Emerald Isle.
Yeah. He called England the Emerald Isle?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Oh, well, okay. Yeah, I mean, they can be a bit cranky sometimes. And frankly, I've had much less trouble with completely foreign languages than I did when I first heard heavily Irish-accented English. It takes you a couple of days to kind of get accustomed to it.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, up until then, it just sounds like gibberish. It's the cadence and everything else is completely different. But
so was
Japan... So every place but China. Go ahead.
So was the college on land and they chartered this ship, or was it on the ship and they just kept sailing?
Oh, no. Oh, on the ship. Yeah, it wasn't a sailing ship. You know, it was, but those are cool too, but that's not what it was. But we were not usually traveling the normal shipping or routes, because back in those days when the academic part of it actually mattered, it doesn't look like I still get alumni stuff. It doesn't look like that's an important consideration now. They're talking about the Wi-Fi in the cabins and stuff like that. And legacy cruises, you know, this was just us and get some malcontents out of the country for a couple months at a time.
That's an extraordinary educational experience. My God, you know, Horace Greeley, go west, young man. You went west and kept going and found that the earth was round. I mean, tell us some of the stuff that happened. You know, you must have met all kinds of intriguing people and had adventures. And I mean, at 18, 19, the best time of your life to be traveling and to have adventures. And I mean,
you forgot strapping the handsome. Yes. Well, let's see. England is terrific. See, a lot of this stuff has changed. Remember, this was 50 years ago. So things are a little different in a lot of places. Like I said, I wouldn't want to do the same thing now unless it was my ship and I could just choose whether I wanted to port there or not, you know. But I remember a big argument we had on board the ship, because we couldn't go into one of the South American ports because they were having an outbreak of something or other. And the ships have to dump their dump off their bilges and get fresh water and stuff like that. And then they can't go to the next place if the last place had cholera or something like that. So that's still the case. So they were all worried about it. They couldn't go there. And we said, well, let's go to Easter Island. And detour is a detour.
I mean, this is like having your own starship. You can visit any planet you want. Oh, my God. What? Ron, what an incredibly lucky adventure. And what were you?
Oh, I know.
Did you go places as part of a curriculum, or did they just have like an itinerary and you had classes that were separated from where you were going to wind up?
Oh, no. There was an itinerary. I mean, you know, you could not show up for stuff. What are they going to do? But
unless you get off the ship.
And in terms of superficial research, someplace like Greece, you know, a couple days and you're done. I mean, if you want to spend more time there, great. But it's not, all the stuff that anybody's ever heard of are all in one place and so forth. So it's, take the day, do Athens. It's not like takes less time than like exploring the Louvre or something.
Was Easter Island part of, you know, biology, evolution?
Well, we didn't go there. We didn't go there.
Oh.
We were, they said, well, maybe the Galapagos. Well, everybody really wanted to go to the Galapagos Islands.
Mm-hmm.
And I will never forgive that one of the professors, he just got all twisted in a knot. And he was practically picketing the halls. Because said, oh, no, no, we'll disturb the environment. We can't have that. We can't put, you know, several hundred. It was just a few hundred, you know, but can't put several hundred people there. And it'll destroy everything and the ecosystem and the turtles. And he's going on and on. And they said, all right. No. So
this was in the 50s and 60s, right?
No, this was in the late 60s. Yeah.
Right.
And of course, within a year, the Chilean government had instituted charter flights and started building tourist facilities there. So that's why that guy remains in my memories of infamy, because it was just so wrong. It was going, anything he was complaining about was going to happen anyway. And we were the last group you could imagine that would have hurt anything.
Well, yeah, well-controlled, looking for, you know, preservation of indigenous environment, scholastic. I mean, he must have been a fanatic. Maybe he just read Rachel Carson, you know.
Well, I went to a Quaker school. We all read Rachel Carson. I wasn't terribly convinced in the first place because I grew up on a farm. I mean, my father would sometimes, to decompress, his idea of decompressing after a long day working in a, well, basically a factory, a dry cleaning plant. He owned it, but he'd go there and, you know, it was, the temperature was 104 in there all the time, you know, and chemicals everywhere. And he'd come home after a long commute, and then he'd get on a tractor and go out and knock stuff over, you know, and dig things just to decompress. That made him feel better. And sometimes he'd do some spraying, and he'd come back in the house looking like Frosty the Snowman, completely, completely dusted with, like, DDT.
Oh, good God.
Of course, he lived in 95.
Well, that's an intriguing paradox.
Yeah, it didn't seem to hurt anything. But
how much did he have to have breathed in?
Well, who knows? Maybe it's just sturdy genes on my family. In my family, I don't know, but it didn't seem to bother him.
That's amazing. So he lived in 95.
Yeah.
With all. Everything has an exception, yeah. I suppose. So, How many countries total do you think you visited?
About 130 or so.
Oh my God! Well, you must have an absolutely treasure trove of stories.
All part of it. Yeah, once I got the bug, I started. You know, it's just I'll give you a story from what the lovely, lovely place formerly known as Yugoslavia. I was there when Tito was still in charge and keeping a hard line of control on the warring groups that wanted really just to beat each other up all the time. They're not quite as death oriented as folks in the Middle East, but you know, they get cranky. And but he wanted to have factories, you know, like DeLoreans and stuff. And so he said, okay, if you start a fight like that on the assembly line, we'll kill you. That's, dictators can do that.
Hmm.
You know, so they all worked together very nicely. And
wait a minute, we're losing your signal.
Okay, that is back.
But you're back.
I didn't move a millimeter. We were probably both drunk at the time. I don't know. We were a bit drunk at the time, but there isn't much else to do there, or there wasn't at the time. And I said, "What's it like living here? You know, I mean, you got, you know, the best standard of living in the Eastern Bloc and so forth, and it's a beautiful country, and people are nice and stuff." And he goes, "It is very boring."
Hmm.
He says,
"Did you ever get to the place that we're going to talk about tomorrow night with Sam Izmanagić, now called Bosnia?"
Well, let's see. That's part.
It used to be part of Yugoslavia. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, then, I kind of saw most of that. It's so there's Serbia, there's Croatia, and there's Bosnia, and I wasn't combing over every square inch of it, and there weren't a lot of ruins there. At least we thought not. We were driving along the road looking for something else, and with, you know, we rented a car and we're tooling along outside of Dubrovnik, and so the guy in the passenger seat looks out and he goes, look up on that hill. And we look up on this ridge that's way up above us and said, there's ruins up there, probably Roman, because the Romans were there
a
long time ago. So we park the Volkswagen, we get out, we hike up through all this scratchy brush, and it took us about an hour, and we get up there, and there's this fort up at the top. Unfortunately, the whole thing was made out of styrofoam.
What?
Left over from some Italian movie crew had just left it there when they finished doing one of those sandal and sword
movies.
That's
like the story of Cecil B. DeMille, who recreated ancient Egypt somewhere in a desert north of Los Angeles. And then at the end of the shoot, they just buried everything.
Right. I think they found that about.
They did.
Ago,
yes. They made a big deal several years ago. In fact, they even made a very crummy sci-fi movie about some monsters buried with the ancient curses of the Egyptian Hollywood, certainly sci-fi.
Oh, is it Jordan or Morocco where you can now go to see Tatooine?
Morocco.
Yeah,
Yeah, that say they say it fell into disrepair, but they got a lot of funding and it's all fixed up and they want to do. I don't know what the tourist aspect of that would be, but that's
you can
yeah,
see
how
you can see everything there but the double suns.
Right.
Okay, yeah, we've got about 3 minutes to the bottom of the hour. When we come back, I want to talk to you about California and the fires. Because you and I were talking, I mean, this is a conversation that's going to skip all over the landscape, folks, so fasten your seatbelts. I have no idea where we're going next, but that's the fun of talking with a generalist, because you never know when an experience is going to come up and say, hey, remember me? So we're going to talk about the fires, because Ron has a very interesting take about what's going on in California right now. And it feeds into one of our other guests. So when we come back, we're going to do all that. My guest this morning is Ron Gerbron. He is, as advertised, a generalist. I mean, what an incredible experience to have an education where you literally get to see the world. I mean, what an extraordinary experience. I used to think my growing up period was interesting. I mean, that... doesn't that beat all? I mean, maybe we'll have to come back to that sometime during the show, because it seems to me that that kind of experience of seeing the world, it's the ultimate adventure of getting on a freighter, you know, when you're a kid and just wandering off into the South Seas to see what there is to see. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard Z. Hoagland, and we shall return.
And his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month. 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The other side of midnight.com.
Welcome back, everyone, to the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is Ron Gerbron, who, among other things, is a member of our Enterprise Mission Imaging team. And we've been talking about his background, seeing the world at 18, 19, not quite on a tramp steamer, but very close, with extraordinary ports of call, introduced him to all kinds of worldly experiences, including looking at ruins And I guess, Ron, I should maybe before we get to the fires, I should ask you about that. Was this growing up experience where you basically got your taste for ancient paleo history and ruins and who the heck are we on this planet?
Oh, no, I got that on the growing up long before that. I mean, the got to remember that that part of Pennsylvania is a very historical area. I mean, literally that kitchen was the original room of the house that got built on after that.
Right.
At the time of the Revolutionary War, it was the only thing that was there, and the local historical society verifies that Washington and Lafayette sat at the table in.
And I think we may have lost you again. You may have to move.
On for a while. That took place right there. They always wanted to put a sign out by the highway. And my dad said, yeah, go ahead. And they said, okay, fine. Need this field.
We're having some you know, you're breaking up. Maybe you need to move to another part of the room or something. Cell phones are not good for interviews.
No, are we okay?
Yeah,
can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's much better. Much better.
Okay, I move it. The phone's moving around inside a little bubble, no bigger than a space helmet. So that's the sweet spot. That was, he didn't want to give him 40 acres of land, so he's out front. So we don't have a sign. But there's a place across the street that had nothing to do with anything that still got a sign that says 1704 Britain House on it. But we used to turn up not arrowheads only, but things like cannonballs and, you know, miscellaneous bits that you would find on a battlefield from back then. Every plot. And it didn't come up during the show, but when you had Jim DeMaio on talking about the Reich stuff,
right?
You know, you didn't get to that, but there's a picture on the, you know, his webpage shows the front of his book, and there's a picture there of this orange box, right from what you can see, and I know what that was because there was one of those sitting in that very same field, that it had been there when my dad bought the place, I guess, and it was.
You're saying on your dad's farm in Pennsylvania there was an orange Orgone tabulator, accumulator, whateverator, sitting on the farm.
You'll have to ask Dr. DeMaio what that DeMaio? Is it DeMaio or DeMaio?
DeMaio.
DeMaio, yeah. You'll have to ask him what those were for. I never knew. I knew, you know, by name. I knew it was, that's some sort of Reich box thing.
Well, I think were designed to affect the crops in terms of increasing yield and maybe affecting weather, because if you interact with the torsion field, you do both. That's what the, you know, decades and decades of research has now shown. And we're calling this different stuff by different names, and it's all the same stuff. It's the ether, it's the torsion field, it's orgone energy, it's the same stuff. So apparently, whoever owned the farm before your dad, either by his own lonesome or because he knew something that other folks didn't, had one of these gadgets installed to increase crop yield or change weather locally over the farm.
Yeah, he was just sitting there. I think the Pennsylvania Farm Bureau, which is, you kind of have to be a farmer to know what that is, but I think they were behind it. They were running some sort of testing. They used to do stuff like that, apparently. And all I know is when I saw it, I was like 7, and within 2 years it was gone. Somebody came and took it back for whatever it was. It wasn't doing anything while I did know it was there. I know that. It was just sitting there, but they took the box, but they left the post. So
I wonder if there could be records. If you could go back, if they're in paper form, they're in cartons in some warehouse. And if they're not, maybe someone's digitized them, but you could see how many of these boxes were scattered around the farm country and what kind of systematic surveys or monitoring whatever were being done.
Yeah, I assume it all just ended suddenly when he got all that political trouble coming down on him. Reich, I mean.
Yeah.
And
right.
So they probably just everybody probably just pulled the plug on anything they were doing that involved any of that. Oh no, we have nothing to do with that. No, that's gone. You know, it's probably something like that. I don't know. Like I said, you had a guest on that probably knows something about that. If not, you could try the Pennsylvania Farm Bureau. We didn't even get to the Sasquatch, but
okay,
Pennsylvania has those, you know.
I've heard, yes. But let's switch gears slightly. Yeah. The fires. You're in California. Yeah. You're in Southern California, right?
Yes, sir.
Are you safe? Because the whole damn state's burning up again.
I mean, it's not quite that bad, but it's the national coverage, I think, is as much because of what the power company is doing. I think this is kind of a thumb to the nose response of theirs for being cited for billions of dollars of liability, because I'm not sure that it was all entirely their fault. They're very, very good about coming out and dealing with stuff that, you know, like a wire down or anything like that.
Right.
So, but if they were just weak and greedy and weren't upgrading stuff, it's not entirely their fault that we don't have the lines buried in the ground or in the undercarriage of a monorail pod or something like we should have. You know, and that's all tied into that concern about EMPs and so forth. You know, we should have that stuff buried and not in a place where it would get affected by a fire, but it's not. So they're liable that much. But beyond that, I don't know. Anyway, they seem to be being a little bitter. They even turned the power off here for half a day a few days ago.
Oh, my.
Like they were testing things out, you know, but what they were doing was they were tree trimming in the neighborhood. I could hear them grinding away at tree branches that were intruding on the lines. They probably should do that more regularly.
Well, the model that they've been proposing is that when you have high winds, because for some reason there has not been maintenance. When I was younger,
yeah.
I used to drive around and we would see these high tension lines looking like, you know, something out of War of the Worlds. You know, these tall crane-like structures against the sky with the drooping high tension lines between them arcing over the landscape. And
yes.
If you were in an airplane, you could see where they were because they would clear with the cooperation of the Forest Service. They would clear a strip of land under the high tension lines. So if they had a break or if they had lines that touched and sparks, the sparks would not fall on foliage. It would fall on essentially small brush ground and it would quickly, you know, cancel itself out. And I don't know whether they're still doing that. I saw some article the other day that said that they were no longer maintaining their right-of-ways. So when you have high winds and the lines swing back and forth and they touch something and they arc, which I find very bizarre in the design, that it's that arcing and those sparks that create these forest fires. And again, it seems like a very convoluted, bizarre explanation for people that don't know anything. Because in all the years growing up around high tension lines, I never heard any of this. And we've had winds.
No.
We've had high tension lines. We've had right-of-way issues. So what's changed? Is this merely a cover story for something much deeper and much more insidious?
A lady I heard speaking on this, on these kind of things, I have to put it that way because I remember – It was a woman, but I don't know who it was, but I don't want to take credit for something. She was going on about how this was connected to the chemtrails, which have a lot of very, 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 very fine aluminum powder in what has been tested out by people that have tried to capture samples and so forth. And if that falls down on the ground, I mean, that's – if you give it enough surface area, you know, by grinding it up really, really fine, aluminum really is like a flash powder. And I think that's coating the trees in a lot of these places. It's just sitting there. And when it gets a little dry and there's a little bit of a spark, they go foomph I mean, I was up at a bus at the bus stop about a half a mile away, and a couple weeks ago, and this little fire started just like a block away, just along the highway.
Right.
I don't know whether whether it was a cigarette butt or what. It doesn't didn't seem like that would be it enough. But I mean, I see this little wisp of smoke, and you know, I like I said, I'm not very far away from it, but there's nothing I can do. I was getting ready to call somebody, and it goes foomph, and it just literally explodes the right word, because I mean, all of a sudden, everything on that hillside is a fire.
Oh, just like the old-fashioned flash powder.
Yeah, yeah, and there was no reason for that. I mean, it was not dense brush or anything like that, but you know, and it starts working on a tree that's up the hill a bit. And all of a sudden, fortunately, I see water spraying on it. And this is just, you know, a minute later, and I'm going, what's going on? So this was either a one of those tests that the fire people do to test out their methods. You know, they've had about 40% of those go awry. You know, they get out of their control, and then they sometimes they're major fires. You know, that happens everywhere. But it could have been something like that, or a construction crew that just caused the tiniest spark, because there's always building going on around here that I couldn't see. And of course, they had a water tank with them. So as soon as they saw something spark, they started spraying water on it. But all I know is within a half an hour, the road was closed. There were more emergency vehicles and fire trucks showing up from far away all of a sudden than there were 12 or so years ago, when we had those big fires that everybody heard about, and I got evacuated for those. That did burn down here, but we skated around it. But it was I did get did have to go to one of those shelters for a couple of days. But the way that fire advanced was just ridiculous. I mean, you know, you've seen brush catch fire, and it doesn't just go thump.
Well, I almost burned down our yard and barn when I was a kid, and my parents had a restaurant, and they told me to go outside and, you know, burn the trash, which was a normal thing in the country. No environmental laws, nobody coming for, to look over your shoulder. So it was a very windy day. I remember I was 10 or 11, and I went down, took it down to the area in front of the barn where we burned stuff. And I dumped it on the ground, and I lit it, and I went back to the house, and I looked out, and the wind had blown some of the papers up under the barn where the chickens were kept. And yes, so I'm seeing the beginnings of a conflagration engulfing the front of the barn where the chickens are. Of course, I'm a kid, 11, 12 years old, so I dash into the restaurant, which is filled with customers in the afternoon. My parents were running a restaurant, and I scream, "There's a fire! There's a fire out back!" And sitting at one table were a bunch of guys who said, "Oh, where would the, I forget the name of the town, volunteer fire department?" And they all stampeded out the back. They kicked out the boards on the barn, saved the chickens, saved the barn. But it took several minutes for it to even begin to burn a major wooden structure. So the idea that just in brush that you can have a flash like you saw indicates something very different. Now, you know, we've had Dane Wigington on a couple, three times, and he's been telling us about the systematic spraying program, the chemtrails, which I think he has another formal scientific name for it, geoengineering, environmental modification, something like that. Anyway, there is a record amount of aluminum, as you just said, in this material that's falling out of the stratosphere as part of this coordinated program. And I saw a number the other day that pre-chemtrails, the amount of aluminum, powdered aluminum in the soil was like 700th of a pound or something like that per acre. And someone did an assay recently and published these notes. They did another set of acreage, and it turns out now to be something like 1,500 pounds per square acre, which is like insane. Where's it coming from? Obviously from the sky.
Yeah, unless the unless the local rodent population is taken to chewing on what is it, bauxite, or raw earth.
Old abandoned Pepsi cans.
Yeah, I don't think that's probably it. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's why I was intrigued by that. So that's I don't like spouting credentialable facts, but that's especially since I saw that fire go swoomph a couple weeks ago. You know, they got it out, like I said, but then the highway ended up closed for 3 hours because I think maybe they were freaked out and they were making sure, or they were just muscling us around.
Intrigued with, and this is where we're going to go off the rails for a lot of people, but I warn you tonight, when you get two generalists together in a bar and they start talking,
yes,
it can go in very strange directions. I have a completely separate idea for why the chemtrail spraying and the aluminum present in the residues. Okay. This goes back to our work with the physics. Remember, the one active element that we now have identified in terms of isomers, which are isotopes that have spins in the nucleus in a certain way, and the torsion field model is rotation, rotation, rotation. The one element that seems to block torsion, a torsion field, torsion measurements, whatever, is aluminum. And it's because of the isomer spins. I began taking note of all this aluminum falling out of the stratosphere, being dumped into the skies through this systematic spraying. I mean, they used to do this here in New Mexico every single day. You'd look up and you'd see these lines or geometric patterns. And one time many years ago, there was a big X right over our house in chemtrail spray. Now, you cannot imagine that's a normal airliner going from Dallas to Los Angeles, stopping to make a big X in the sky. I don't think so. This was back when I was on Art Bell a lot and I was talking about this stuff. Think of this. If aluminum blocks torsion and the torsion field is basically the conveyor of consciousness for intelligent creatures on planet Earth, and someone is trying to block our connection to the field to keep us dumbed down, could this be the reason for the massive chemtrail spraying with, among other things, active agent aluminum in the residue?
Could be.
And how would
probably
we test?
Is.
How would we test for that? Because it's global. And again, the model says that the physics is rising to a point where people should be really, really, really sharper and catching on to things much quicker. And of course, in some areas, they are. But if there was a systematic effort to keep people dumbed down so they don't notice what's going on politically, culturally, geopolitically, globally, environmentally, etc., what better way than to cut off their access to the field? I mean, you know the studies that basically trace now the origins of Alzheimer's to an excess of aluminum in the brain, right?
Yeah, I've heard that, yes.
And I think it's the same thing. I think Alzheimer's is basically when you're cut off from the field or source or whatever you want to call it, people lose their minds. And I think every Alzheimer's case where they have taken the trouble to trace the aluminum content, they find a correlation.
Uh-huh.
Now, correlation is not causation, but if this is really, you know, if we're really walking VR examples, that consciousness is not in your brain, but your brain is basically a transceiver, so it connects to the you that really is, you know, somewhere up the line, other dimension, higher dimension, in the field, whatever. If you cut
sure.
off that connection, what are you going to wind up with if taken to the ultimate extreme? Alzheimer's disease. At least that's my very speculative idea.
Well, here's the same thing said from a slightly different perspective, I think, because this is the way I look at it. There's it's it's been clear to me for a long time that there's some sort of assembly of minds. You know, they people talk about their higher self and so forth, but that's something that's like unique to humans. A lot of animals don't each have a soul and a higher mind, but they share a group mind. You know, this is why birds that are migrating make those precision turns when they're in the
incredible flocking maneuvers, and dolphins and swordfish and piranhas. I mean, the flocking or group instincts.
Ants.
Yes.
Yeah. They're those kind of maneuvers are governed by their group mind, and so what that means is that there's a template. A lot of people talk about the human configuration being basically a template. Well, I think just like anything, we've got extraordinary self-repair capabilities, but it's based upon that. It's like the boot record on an old computer. You know, like you had a fallback. You know, it said, oh, you really screwed everything up and you got this malware that just deleted half your apps. And so we're going to, you're going to have to go back to the and let the machine put the original pieces back. Well, I think you have something like that in the genome, but it's a template. It's like part of the body's muscle memory and that and the chemical parts of that. And so that would connect also with that oversoul group mind. There's a million names for it. And that's very hyperdimensional or resonant, if you will. But the more you can identify with it, the more you can tie those together, the more effectively you can repair things in yourself. Because you're normally fighting against yourself all the time. Like when you eat most of what you like to eat. And I'm not going to stop eating what I like to eat. That's by God. That's what it's for. We're supposed to deal with this stuff, and for the vast audience out there. No, I'm not fat.
Ron is definitely not fat.
I wear the same pants. I say, yeah, some of them are the same.
But you do a lot of walking.
The same pants I did in high school. Yeah, I do. Less than I used to, but when I was younger, I was one of those compulsive exercise people. You know, I mean, it's ridiculous, but you try and be subtle about it. You know, it's like in a Jason Bourne movie, you know, every time he sees a tree limb, he jumps up and does a couple chin-ups on it, that kind of thing.
When I was working in New York, cabs are, I hated subways, stuck in a hole in the ground, regardless of what that movie said. And cabs, of course, are phenomenally expensive. So unless I was on an expense account with the networks or whatever, I would walk the length and breadth of Manhattan. And it's really doable. Mm. You know, it's a wonderful place to walk. I used to try to stay out of Central Park after midnight, but I would walk an awful lot in New York, and I maintain a very youthful figure, as they used to say.
Yes, you do. You're quite fit. I
do less walking in the desert, particularly during the summer, because it gets so infernally hot. So my walking is kind of confined to sunrises and sunsets, mostly sunsets. But as the weather gets cooler, I can do more walking. And we have lots of hills here. So okay, if this model is not crazy, you're saying that consciousness basically starts out as a group template, and then as we're more conscious, there's more individualization. Is that a word?
Individuation, I think.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, but something like that. Pretty much. So people can look at that as individual uniqueness as much as they like. I mean, most of the stories that people have, most of the narratives that are out there about what humanity is, have certain common elements that work. You know, like when you talk about this as the meat body or the carrier or a vessel or anything like that. These are not concepts that were alien to, people in ancient times and various cultures either. It's just there's something almost common sense about it, and like if you've ever sadly seen someone die, you can see something leave.
I've heard
that. Not just that. I've heard that they get very, very still. Yeah. I mean, if you're a professional killer, then you kind of enjoy watching that, I guess. But other than that, it's a bit disturbing. There was a character on Game of Thrones that used to say that. They said there was Clegane. He said there's nothing like it. Nothing like it. Well, okay, that's fine for him. But you can make it metaphysical. You can make it medical. You can make it religious, and it all is talking about pretty much the same thing.
Well, the thing that occurs to me is these coincidences, because you got the physics peaking. We're coming up to a node, the famous Mayan calendar, once every 26,000 years. 2012 really wasn't 2012, it was 2016, and now we're living in the aftermath. That's according to the numbers. Okay. If consciousness should peak, if receptivity, if our higher selves can communicate better now than at any other time, maybe in the last 6,000 years or 12,000 or 26,000, and there's a hidden agenda to keep people, you know, as Alex Jones says, you know, on a prison planet, what better way than to use as an excuse the chemtrailing of the skies so that you could basically just keep them down on the farm by keeping them fat, dumb, and happy?
Right. Well, they're fat, they're dumb. I don't know how happy people are at the moment, but
that's right. That's right. Okay, hold it there. We're at the top of the hour. My guest this morning is Ron Gerbron, and as you can see, our conversation is going in very unpredicted changes. So just hang in there. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return. Thanks for listening to this exciting first hour. Now, the second and third hour of the show is available to Club 19.5 members only. Please support the show by subscribing to Club 19.5 and join our very interesting community. To do that, please visit the website, theothersideofmidnight.com, and click on the Join Club 19.5 link in the left-hand column. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350-plus shows that we have done. Now, recent Club 19.5 member archive recording have the commercials removed, and the sound quality has been enhanced. You'll also receive a dedicated private podcast feed that contains these enhanced show recordings. And you'll be able to download the MP3 files directly from the archive if you prefer. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll also be the first to preview our new videos and reports. We'll be adding exclusive new features to Club 19.5 as we go forward, and boy, have we got some amazing things to tell you about in the coming weeks. So please support the show and don't miss all the exciting new things we have planned. I want to thank all our Club 19.5 members, because without your guys' support, this show would not be on the air. Please help us continue growing the show by subscribing to Club 19.5 today. And when I say we really need you, we really need you. Over and out.